Hello, dear listener. Today, we invite you to listen in on a recent broadcast we shared on LinkedIn.
Yes, and we talked all about challenges facing the industry, and I spoke with Emmanuel Labat, President of Genomic Medicine at Cytiva, and with the CEO and co-founder of Foresight Bio, Inki He. We focused a little bit on genomic medicines and cell and gene therapy.
So let's listen to some highlights from that conversation, and then we're going to bring in a new guest about the challenges in finding the right talent in our evolving industry.
The findings of the Biopharma Resilience Index are what matter today on Discovery Matters.
Our involvement with genomic medicine goes way back. Yeah. We've been involved in cell therapy manufacturing, viral vector manufacturing for years. Now, I think as we look at the space and we look at the progress of trials, the maturity and the expectations of our customers for better solutions, because truly the future of those therapies is not only about inventing them, it's also about manufacturing them in a better way.
We're seeing that transition from an industry which is basically researching and developing therapeutics to actually nailing down the complexities of actually making manufacturing.
And improving it.
Yeah,
and improving
exactly. It. Very, very exciting. This is the first show that we've done on this scale after the merger of the life sciences business of Paul and Cytiva. How has that changed what we're able to do and to talk to customers about?
I mean, I think two things. One is workflow. They want us to help them end to end, from cell to vial. And, you know, historically, if I take an example, for instance, viral vector manufacturing, our very, very strong upstream recent example is the acquisition of Cevec, you know, stable producer cell line last summer. So a lot of know-how and product expertise upstream. And Cytiva, of course, very strong through the rest of the portfolio downstream, all the way to fill and finish. And so when we bring all those things together, truly from a solution perspective, we're able to consult and help customers end to end. The second thing is people, right? And, you know, this is about talents. And I think bringing those two things together brings a huge breadth of R&D talents, commercial talents to further enhance the solutions and help customers. So very exciting, very complementary. And with this is true in cell therapy, this is true in nucleic acid-based manufacturing, this is true for viral vector. And now non-viral delivery with the integration of PNI. For the past couple of years. So a really full set of solutions now.
So a full set of solutions wrapped in expertise and talent.
Right.
Sounds very, very familiar. We've done that once in monoclonal antibodies, and we're doing this for the future of medicine. Let's talk a little bit about the index. We do the Biopharma Resilience Index every couple of years. We've interviewed 1,250 leaders in the industry across the whole world in 22 different countries. And we talk to them about five different pillars of the industry: supply chain resilience, the R&D ecosystem, talent, manufacturing agility, and of course, government policy and the regulatory landscape. And so, Emmanuel, it's encouraging. We're seeing progress in a couple of places, but also we're continued to be challenged as an industry, specifically in R&D collaboration. Our interviewees are saying it's not as good as it used to be.
I agree. And you know, I think that was one of the most surprising shift where we're seeing the attitude towards R&D less positive than it was 2 years ago. There's two reasons. One is the complexity and the diversity of all those therapies and modalities, right? I think it's just, you can't do things alone. So I think there is an appetite, even more appetite for collaboration than it used to be. And therefore, maybe a little bit of frustration that this is not happening as much as it should. I think in a lot of places, the IP landscape is very complicated to navigate. So there is an element that this industry is becoming richer, more complex, and the collaboration is harder than maybe what it used to be. And I think there is another element, which is there's been a lot of investments in that space. And the actors are by nature a little bit competitive. That might be a barrier to collaboration. Now, my own experience is that doors are rarely shut. Okay. And I think if you do things in the right way, I think there is ways to collaborate. I think everybody realized that this is absolutely necessary. I think the report illustrates that in some places, a third party, maybe a local government, can help in triggering collaboration. I think Cytiva can play a role because of our exposure. Collaboration will continue to happen.
And then in areas where the industry might have a little bit more control of its own progress, like supply chain resilience and manufacturing agility. We're seeing things a little bit better than they were before. True. So what's driving that, do you think?
I think the industry, supported by governments, have learned from COVID. I think some basic infrastructure, more local, multiple supplier source, things have taken place. I think there is still a way to go in some biologies, mAbs, cell, gene therapy, where there is probably a need for even more local. Okay, but I think there's been, thankfully, some learnings from COVID.
So in fact, 20% of our respondents said that supply chain resilience domestically was fundamental as one of their priorities for the next 2 years.
At this stage, I invited Inge to tell us a little bit about Foresight Bio and what it is they do.
Foresight Bio is a one-stop, end-to-end service provider for CGT companies. So we provide contract research, development, and manufacturing services to these companies in US and in China.
So you're working with companies from the very beginning of the development of their therapies right the way through to manufacturing for the clinic. And you have a new manufacturing facility in Shanghai. Let's talk a little bit about talent, because that's been a challenge in the first index. It remains a challenge in this issue of the index. How do you experience the difference in access to talent across the two sites that you have?
That's a great question. I think when I saw the index results, I think, wow, that's really resonate with what we have experienced. The Foresight started in 2021, and we have been struggling to get talents to join us to really kind of build up the capacity on both sides. However, there are some differences. In US, it's quite difficult right now to get very experienced talents here, but still you can find some. But just getting difficult. But in China, it's almost, I have to say, there's not that many experienced talent pool to tap into. Most of them are relatively fresh, especially in the cell gene therapy industry.
And is this an emerging area, and that's what's driving the need for new skills and development? And is it in a particular area, or is it in GMP manufacturing, or is it in development? Where are you seeing the hardest ability to recruit people to serve your customers?
That's really a good question. I think for China, because in cell gene therapy, China's industrialized experience is relatively limited because it's in the early stage compared to in US. So especially in GMP manufacturing field, the talent is really lacking. Relatively, we can find more experienced people, but it just it's a really competitive market right now. So we have to compete with different companies for these talents.
Which is good news for the talent, but also quite difficult for the companies themselves.
That's right.
So the government policies and regulations are markedly different in China and in the US. Are you seeing that those are supporting the development of your customers' therapies in the right way? And how do you respond to those different kind of policy environments?
The two governments are all pretty much focusing on promoting biotech industry, especially in the innovation space, like cell gene therapy, these kind of advanced therapies. However, we need more collaboration across the board because different countries have different advantages and the resources we can leverage. I think if we can collaborate more, it will really help accelerate the development of the technology and industry, and then especially the medicines to patients. We have seen a lot of collaboration with academics more than in China, and the collaboration with different companies, especially there's more contract work from the US customers to the CDMO, CRO like us, versus in China, the companies are more tend to work with their internal resources.
Keep it in-house and build their own resources and talents, driving a very different attitude to how you bring the therapies to market. We in the industry, we're very focused on how do we get the therapy to market, but mm-hmm. then when you put that within the context of the biotech industry, there's so many layers of policy and regulation that go around it, mm-hmm. which are driven by countries' different industrial policies, countries' different focuses on building high-tech manufacturing sectors. So you see these differences appearing across the countries. One of the things that we saw go up in the index this year was manufacturing agility. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because I'm specifically interested mm-hmm. in the fact that you have two sites, one in China and one in the US. So how do you see that playing out for yourselves?
We are answering the needs from the customers mm-hmm. to having that agility, especially with the pandemic. Mm. People see the need to have local manufacturing capacities to help secure the supply chain. So having multiple manufacturing options for our customers to choose from and having this kind of flexibility and provide a much easier access for the customers locally. So I think that's the need for we have seen from the customers. So that's how we actually set up the two manufacturing sites in US and in China at the same time to address that. That's how almost all the companies are thinking about that. Mm-hmm. I have seen Cytiva mm-hmm. and also other CDMO companies mm-hmm. are doing that.
Yes.
Because I think that we have seen the need.
The focus on becoming local in-country mm-hmm. for country, which was really accelerated by the pandemic, has then mm-hmm. made us rethink a little bit about how we're local for diseases which are hopefully going to be the ones we focus on more rather than infectious disease.
And then we brought audience questions to Connor, Emmanuel, and Inke.
There are five pillars in the Biopharma Resilience Index. Which one is most important? So take your pick between talent, supply chain, R&D ecosystem, government regulation, or manufacturing agility.
It's hard to pick one, but I want to go back on the R&D collaboration. Because I think, you know, this industry is based on progress. It's based on science. Mm. And like we discussed earlier, the complexity, the diversity of modalities, the diversity of way to manufacture is so big that nobody can do it alone, right? So I think having an ecosystem that is a little bit more collaborative in nature is necessary to progress. And I think the fact that it is acknowledged that this is not good enough, I think is honestly that as a positive sign that we need to do better collectively.
It's a very difficult one to pick, but with foresight at this stage, we are still in the starting phase, right? To us, especially in China, is talent. We need more skill for talents in the industry to really help us to build the capacity and capabilities to support our customers. And then actually, to your point, we can get more talent with the collaboration within the R&D.
The real insight for me across these things is where the industry, where companies feel that they have the most control on manufacturing agility and on supply chain resilience, companies feel that they have made a lot of progress. And that's perhaps been driven largely by the response to the challenges of supplying customers during the pandemic. We, of course, saw a lot of collaboration across government policies, makers, and so on to accelerate vaccines to market during the pandemic. And it feels that some of our respondents were saying, okay, now we're back to how it was before the pandemic. We saw this massive rush to get things through, to get the vaccines on the market, but now some countries have stepped back to how it was before. Many countries have learned and are continuing to use those lessons from the pandemic to drive things forward. But really, the industry where it has control feels it has moved forward. Where it has to partner with others, it's feeling still very challenged.
There are three pillars that have declined. It's easy to feel disheartened by some of these results when the industry has been so busy for 3 years. But that aside, what makes you feel optimistic about the industry?
Being here at BIO and having this conversation with Cytiva gave me a lot of hope, because to think about 2-3 years ago, with the pandemic, we couldn't do this, right? I think with more communication across the board, I think we are going to bring more talent kind of development. And we also will influence the R&D ecosystem, right? So more interaction. And hopefully we can actually influence the government policies more, especially on the geopolitical side.
What we're seeing at Bayer and other shows is a continuum of funding, innovation. I mean, for the past 3 years, in a way, the expectations from this industry, which is really coming at the forefront everywhere, is huge, right? And so there may be a little bit of frustration that we're not delivering yet to the level of expectation that all the actors would like to see. But that's because we're at the forefront of what's happening, and especially over the past 2-3 years. But in the background, the investments continue to be there, innovations continue to be there, both from pharma, biotechs, and solutions provider like us, or service provider like yourself. So I think the momentum is overall positive.
And it's very easy to get tied up in the frustrations of what it means to drive the industry forward. But we just need to look back and think about how far we've come. You know, there's CAR-T on the market that is curative, right? And I remember when we first started in this industry, however many years ago, that was a real challenge. We all have personal experiences of the patient impact. I certainly have, you know, very close friends who are no longer with us who might actually be with us now because there are approved therapies on the market that have been driven by this industry. And that gives us real hope for the patient impact.
Do you think that the focus on local manufacturing is driving cost upward? Could perhaps that cost question force a globalization again of manufacturing, particularly in the genomic medicine space?
I think the biggest driver of cost down is innovation. New solutions, new biologics, better cell line, better bioreactors, more automation. That is what is going to drive cost down. Now, it's a roadmap. It takes years to get there. It is tempting to say local is the solution. But then indeed, by doing more local, then we reduce scale. It is a fine balance. But at the end of the day, I really believe that cost down will be achieved by innovation.
I totally agree with Emilio's point is innovation. So people also, I think right now we have AI, so hot, right? Mm-hmm. And automation. And then we are lacking of GMP manufacturing talents. Hopefully, we can use some of the automation and AI technologies to address that.
I was reminded yesterday the biggest cost issue, maybe beside talent, is a failed batch.
Right.
So not having the right level of process control, automation, and talents to actually do your clinical trials is key. And that's where, you know, going too decentralized at some point might find its limits. Right?
A fine line between digitization, the use of advanced machine learning technologies, but then, of course, localization where it makes sense to actually take cost out of the system. Yeah. And, of course, the aim of all of this is to increase access to these therapies for patients globally. We really want to, you know, remove the focus on the developed world and really help get this accessible approach to therapies across all of the patients.
If you read to the end of the report, and it's not that painful, it's a pretty brief report, but at the end, Cytiva makes 5 recommendations about each of the pillars. In particular, the one about talent says, address this talent shortage with upskilling, retention, training. There are some partnerships that are on the way. What are some good examples of how we're really trying to address that talent shortage? What are some of your favorites?
It's so interesting is that these recommendations cross over the pillars as well. So you have the fact that we need more talent in the industry being addressed by collaboration across the industry, both with governments, but then also with some other kind of non-industry organizations. So one of my favorites is the collaboration that we have with NIBERT to help drive talent and skills into biomanufacturing in Ireland. We see that kind of collaboration with many companies with local and global training providers and developers who are focused on skills, and they almost always have a connection back to some form of government policy, some form of alignment with the government's intention to build a high-impact, high-tech manufacturing sector.
In China right now, they have some talent kind of incentive programs. They focus on in certain industries. So one of them is in biotech industry. I feel like there is more the government's kind of initiatives to set these incubator centers to collect certain talents under one roof to support different companies. So then those like small biotech companies, they don't have to set up their own shop for that kind of functions.
So these kind of centers of excellence or incubation areas or hotbeds of innovation. And it's interesting that the sort of the recommendation that the survey makes on talent or the result very closely to aligning a long-term roadmap between government and industry and policies. So it's not just about how you regulate the therapies themselves, it's how you put mechanisms in place so that you are bringing the future generations of university students and school students into the industry, because it's a really exciting place to be.
It was a really lively conversation with Emmanuel and Inke.
Agreed. And you know, if we're able to overcome the challenges in front of us, we can get therapies to patients more easily and effectively.
Exactly. However, the focus needs to be looking at and understanding the whole ecosystem of all of these challenges and how they relate to one another, from the regulatory landscape, because that sets the climate of how we work together to overcome those challenges, right the way through to challenges in talent and so on and so forth. But let's not forget that talent is actually the axis on which this whole industry revolves. And actually, the talent is why I stay in this industry.
For sure, it matters who we work with, who we spend all those daylight hours with. And frankly, that's you, our listener out there, looking at you. Yeah. Those who work in plants, in the research institutions, the academic institutions, the translational hubs, and of course, the CMOs, the innovator companies, and biopharma as a whole. It's all of us that make this industry tick.
So let's go a little bit deeper on this topic of talent.
Right. We got in touch with Dr. Linnea Fletcher. She is the executive director for Innovate Bio, and that is the National Biotechnology Education Center funded by the National Science Foundation in the U.S. And it is responsible for supporting over 130 two-year biotech programs at community colleges across the nation. So in the United States, community college, it's sometimes called junior college around the world. It is not university level, but it's after high school level, and it's open to everyone. So the job of Innovate Bio is to produce the technicians for the industry. And as an educator, Dr. Fletcher has observed how talent must be interdisciplinary. These people who are learning things, they have to learn several areas of science and technology to get to where they need to be.
They don't stay in a silo. They don't stay in that one job. They actually then move cross industry, or they move into other positions, or they move up the chain, and they have to gain additional knowledge. So no one stays in one area of biology or biotech anymore. You may start on the line of manufacturing and you end up in QA/QC. You may end up being a CEO when you started off as a technician. No one just gets one job in their life and stays in that one job. They're constantly learning and moving, because that's what it demands. The changes in biotech are so dramatic that if you don't keep moving, you will not keep up.
Much like ourselves, we often say, no silos, break the silos. And it does sound cliche, but cliches are true for a reason, right? I mean, so Innovate Bio is taking the challenge into their own hands.
We're having this summit in DC in June, and we've invited government, industry, nonprofits, trade organizations, and education together. Is policy has to be made. If you look at state policies and federal policies related to education, high school is treated as one entity. College is treated as a totally different entity. And those two entities don't necessarily articulate.
So this really means that some of the courses in high school don't tie in with the college courses. So the education curriculum isn't seamless and is not doing the best that it could do.
I know. Imagine how tricky and disheartening it would be to pursue a career and then find out that you're just relearning content or facing a difficult jump up to more advanced work with no time for adjustment.
The other thing we need to do economically, too, is that to encourage innovation, we have a science incubator at our community college that I started years ago because startups needed the access to equipment and people because they just couldn't hire enough people or buy that expensive equipment. And I needed to have my students learning cutting edge information. So then people in startups would teach my internship course. They have access to my equipment and my students who they were teaching while they were doing projects, and they would give me the supplies because I couldn't afford them.
That's a collaborative solution, a mutually beneficial ecosystem. We're using this word a lot today, that allows startups to decrease costs for product development and to help students learn the latest techniques.
That's right. Linnea's students have the opportunity to work with equipment that they wouldn't normally be working with at this stage in their education. It took 6 years of convincing for Linnea to get the state to build an incubator at her community college. So this, Linnea has perseverance.
They had their bias or their preconceived notions of what a community college should be, and it was not an economic driver for the local area or the state. But it was, in many ways, it's better because the community college does not want to deal with IP. So unlike incubators at universities, where IP actually becomes an issue for these startups because the university wants part of it, at our community college, there's no discussion of it. They just come in, they rent a bench, they have access to equipment, they bring in their supplies, and they have access to students.
Working with governments is another area that we talked about in the index report. There are so many elements that need to come together to build a better climate for talent, to build more resilience in the industry.
Right now, we cannot meet the needs of this workforce. And if we don't change how we collaborate and work together, we are not going to meet the needs.
It just goes to show how important addressing the pillars raised in the index are across all areas of the industry. You can't have one without the other. All five are meaningful. So where to get the full report is in our show notes, but also you can remember it quite easily because it's Cytiva.com/resilience.
So
what did we learn?
What did we learn this week?
I have something.
What did you learn?
It actually came from you, Connor. So when you share with a small community on WhatsApp some market and customer insights, and you shared an article about artificial intelligence, surprise, surprise. But within that story about artificial intelligence and how it's going to save humanity is a link to what's called the Pessimist's Archive, pessimistsarchive.org. And I went down the rabbit hole following this link, and it was absolutely incredible because how to sum it up is that at every innovative technological advance, humanity has lived in fear. So on the Pessimist's Archive, you go on this timeline, and in 1850, it was about how the telegraph was going to bring about the end of humans. And in 1870, photography. People thought photography was obscene.
Would be the end of the... Yes, indeed. And I imagine
exactly.
It was the same with the printing press, right? Every new development in technology is going to bring about the end of something.
That's right. Dig this. In 1890, the bicycle was blamed for turning people insane and devastating local economies. And this one won't surprise us, sadly, but the bicycle was blamed for destroying women's morals.
So listening, we talked about like people getting together, and here's the thing, you know, when people get together, what happens? Sometimes they make babies. And Dodie, you and I, we talk about the microbiome a lot, and we know that mothers that deliver their babies naturally provide them with the beginnings of vaginal delivery. Yes, they provide them with the beginnings of a microbiome, the body's collection of microbes in the gut and the skin and so on. And one of the fears is that cesarean section delivered babies, whether elective or whether through emergency cesarean sections, perhaps don't benefit from that early stage of absorbing the mother's microbiome as they proceed through the birth canal. And this has been shown that studies have identified differences in the microbiomes of C-section babies and vaginally delivered children. C-section babies have higher levels of opportunistic bacteria, right? The stuff that they might just pick up in hospital. And they perhaps have less, you know, common gut microbes than you would expect to see. Now, it appears that vaginal seeding of bacteria, that is taking bacteria from the birth canal and spreading it on children as they are born, smeared with those fluids, can really help encourage a microbiome that could improve brain development. And this has been shown in the biggest study yet, because it is quite a controversial practice, as it were, to, you know, essentially smear a cesarean section baby with with their mother's vaginal fluids to encourage the development of the microbiome. Anyway, this trial has shown that it works.
I love that. It's a really nice follow up. You remember, Connor, a couple of years ago when we were at Bio in Boston, our episode number 8 of Discovery Matters, we talked to a couple of experts who were exploring the microbiome transplant possibilities. So that's a super cool follow-up.
That is. And you could actually, you know, find that episode, which is deeply relevant to this research,
right,
on wherever it is you find your podcasts.
Yes. Where you could also rate us, if you like. Give us whatever number of stars you think are right. The more the merrier.
Yeah, 5 stars is always good, right? But if you think we're doing a lousy job, please tell us, you know.
Yeah, that's fair too.
Find us on LinkedIn and, you know, send us a flaming email.
Do it. Meanwhile, our producer is Beth Armit Brewster. Editing, mixing, and supervision is by Banda Productions. The music we take from Epidemic Sound. And my name is Dodie Axelson.
And I am Connor McKechnie. We will see you, you will hear us, when we come back with another episode of Discovery Matters.